Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 11th of March, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen, 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Pat, the Brexit comedy show continues, and we don't like covering Brexit anymore, but since there's another meaningful vote tomorrow, allegedly, possibly, maybe, then perhaps it's worth just having a look at what's going on. So this meaningful vote tomorrow in the House of Commons, or possibly not, because it may be that it becomes just a guidance vote in the unlikely situation that Theresa May would win it. Then she has something to take to the European Council meeting on the 22nd of March. If it's rejected, then they could possibly have some other votes which might involve delaying the Brexit process, delaying so it wouldn't be the 29th of March anymore. It would possibly be, as somebody said in the chat box earlier, the 29th of never, because that's certainly increasingly what's likely to happen. Now, of course, the only possibility that she has of winning this vote tonight is if she's got something new to add. So over the weekend, Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General, was in Brussels. He went to Brussels and met with he went to Brussels with Stephen Barclay, who's the Brexit Secretary, and Sir Tim Barrow, and they met with Michel Barnier. They had a very nice dinner, apparently. They said it was a very nice dinner, but apparently Michel Barnier and his team laughed at Geoffrey Cox a bit. So that's really where we've got to at the moment. The Times reporting today that all but two constituencies want their MP to reject Theresa May's deal. This is a result of a YouGov poll, apparently. 632 parliamentary constituencies in England, Scotland and Wales want their MPs to reject Theresa May's Brexit deal. So I think what this reinforces once again, Pat, really fascinating aspect of this situation, and that is that nobody likes this deal, whether they're on the Brexit side or the Remain side. And therefore, there is complete agreement amongst everybody that Theresa May's deal should be binned at the earliest possible opportunity. But in the meantime, of course, the calls for a second referendum ramp up. And well, Tony Blair was...
there he is.
There he is. Delightful man. And this is the Tony Blair Institute has pushed out this little video clip where we were promised, he said, by the Prime Minister and Vote Leave, that we'd know Britain's future relationship with the EU before Brexit. MPs must reject a painful no-deal Brexit, reject the PM's pointless deal, and in light of all we now know, put the decision back to the people. So he's calling for a second referendum, of course.
This is the new leader of the Labour Party, right?
And of course, you know, the point here is, why has this man still got any input into British politics at all? Well, we might come on to that in a minute. So Theresa May, Tony Blair, do you see a bit of a Freudian slip there? Tony Blair pushing this out today, all the reasons why we need to stay in Europe, have a second referendum and so on. What's at the back of this? Well, of course, it's the backstop. And as the point that we've made many, many times over the last 2.5 years, Patrick, is of course the backstop situation was understood on day one following the referendum result. And so here we are 2.5 years later. It can be nothing other than intentional that we're in this situation. But, Patrick, I have a solution to the problem.
Really? You've got a solution to the most complicated political problem in the world, the farrago of farragos, and you've got a solution?
Absolutely. There really is no problem about this whatsoever. Britain and Ireland joined the EU on the same day. The simple solution, and thanks for the graphic, Patrick, the simple solution is that we both leave together on the same day. And then there's no problem about the Northern Irish border. Everything goes back to normal.
And doesn't it look like such fun as well? They look like they're having the time of their life, Mike.
Yes.
These two, these British and Ireland, holding hands, jumping off into the unknown together. Well, not really the unknown, but leaving together.
Leaving together, leaving hand together. In hand. That should be...
It's the slogan, isn't yes. it? Hashtag leaving together.
That would solve the problem.
We'll catch on.
That would solve the problem.
That's pretty catchy, Mike. I like that.
Now, there's another Times article that I wanted to discuss on the issue of Brexit, and it's this one, which appeared over the weekend. I can reveal Whitehall's secret Brexit plan, stop it dead. Now, this is apparently an anonymous civil servant writing in this on the Sunday Times. And he begins by saying the four core values of the civil service are honesty, integrity, impartiality and objectivity. And if anybody can swallow that without being ill, then we go on. Before joining the organisation, I had believed naively that these values would be upheld unconditionally. I very quickly came to learn that in relation to Brexit, nothing could be further from the truth. Unfortunately, I must remain anonymous for fear of the backlash I would receive at my place of work. However, I can reveal that I'm a senior policy professional within the civil service and work closely with numerous government departments. And he goes on to talk about how actually civil service, probably 90% of them, the people working in the civil service, are for Remain. He said this is worrying in itself and far from representative of the 52% of the population who voted for Brexit. Most horrifying, however, is the sheer disdain and utter contempt that my colleagues display towards people who voted to leave. I've lost count of the number of insulting and derogatory terms that are used in my own department and elsewhere to refer to the 17.4 million people who voted for Brexit. Racist, stupid, uneducated, anti-Brexit jokes and snide remarks are dropped casually into everyday office conversations. Well, this is a very interesting situation because, of course, he goes on to talk about the civil service and the role of the civil service. This comes back to Tony Blair in some respects, because what is the role of the civil service? In fact, that role has changed. We've had two or three different Brexit ministers who are supposed to be running the negotiations, Theresa May saying that she's taking a personal hand in the negotiations over Brexit. But of course, in reality, politicians haven't been taking any particular role in the negotiations. This has been a civil service job, particularly from the Cabinet Office. Times article then absolutely reinforces an article that our old friend Chris Donnelly from the Integrity Initiative wrote quite some time ago now, but he was talking about the changing nature of governance in Britain. And one of the things he said was that, Tony Blair, he said the governance of the UK has evolved over a long period and as a result is more complex and less obvious than that of many other democracies. Following the constitutional changes of the last Labour government, that's the Blair government and the Brown government, which have in the main been continued by the current coalition. So he wrote this article in 2016. The past decade has seen a rapid revolution of this governance process, which is still underway. And he goes on to point out that power has been centralised in the Prime Minister's office. Of course, the Prime Minister's office is a subset of the Cabinet office. He said, under Prime Minister Tony Blair, the role of the Cabinet was reduced in favour of centralising power in the Prime Minister's office. In an attempt to compensate for this loss of coherence, as well as to bring policy making more under the direct control of the Prime Minister, policy was made primarily a Cabinet Office responsibility. Departments were reduced to elaborating policy. Well, this is a staggering admission, Patrick, because the traditional way of governance in this country is that Ministers of State, Secretary of State decide on what the policy is. The civil service implements that policy, and that's done at a departmental level, and it's done as a result of cabinet discussions and collective cabinet decision making. And what Donnelly was pointing out in this paper is that since Tony Blair, that situation has been turned on its head. The policy is being made inside the cabinet office. The policy is being fed out to secretaries of state at the cabinet table. And their job is merely to implement that policy. So they have no role in setting the policy particularly. And the other point that he was making is just the sheer size that the cabinet office has become. So this is, as I say, we're going back a few years that he wrote this. The cabinet office used to be a staff of hundreds. It's now, well, when he wrote this, it was over 3,000 staff. And he made the point that actually, even for somebody that has the government connections that Chris Donnelly has, he finds it very, very difficult to actually understand who is working in the cabinet office, who what the roles are, what they actually do, and so on. So this is a very important point with respect to Brexit, because if, as this Times article is saying, 90% of civil servants are for Remain, and if, as Donnelly is saying, policy is being devised by the civil service and operated through the government rather than the other way around, then really there was never any chance for Brexit to succeed.
So are you insinuating, Mike, that there's the Cabinet Office has intentionally gummed up the works, as it were, or there's a sort of type of a sabotage of the process, maybe not directly, but rolling out policies that are DOA, dead on arrival anyway, but still pushing those through the system, knowing full well that they're going to run up against some opposition and maybe friction?
Well, you've got to assume that these people are not totally stupid because they are in high-level roles. But I don't think insinuation is necessary because you only have to look at the results. Many people say this is the result of incompetence, bad mishandling by the Tory government and so on. I cannot accept that. And I think that if you're actually looking at this situation objectively, it's very hard to accept that because we are at the position right up against the deadline of the Irish border being a problem. That was known about, as we said, 2.5 years ago. It was not by accident that we've got to the point where that is a crisis.
If what you say is true and that the revolution of government or governance inverting the function of government between the ministerial offices and the cabinet offices, and that was the Blair revolution.
Yes.
That was the silent revolution under New Labour. If this is true, Mike, and then the sudden emergence of Tony Blair on the political scene, after being more or less removed from day-to-day political issues and affairs in Britain, and all of a sudden, exit stage left, here's Tony Blair, appears on the scene with these beautiful graphics, which we showed you today, and a perfect explanation of the right way out of this terrible situation, Mike. And the Hegelian dialectic certainly comes to mind here,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes.
Problem, reaction, solution. And whether you think all three of these things converging right now are a coincidence or not, I think you do have to look at the underlying structures of where policy emanates, how policy moves, and put that in the context of Brexit. And I think you might find some answers to this so-called stalemate that we're looking at.
Well, absolutely. And the final point to make on this is, of course, this change that began with Tony Blair, but which was absolutely pursued through the Cameron Clegg government and through Theresa May's government, is fundamentally unconstitutional. This is not the nature of parliamentary democracy as far as the English constitution or the British constitution is concerned.
It's been restructured.
This restructuring was not agreed, and most people don't even understand that it has happened. You know, there are constitutional issues here as well, and I would just refer people back to the John Bingley article that's on the front page of the UK Column website at the moment. You'll find it quite obviously there.
Would it be fair to call this a bureaucratic coup?
I think that would be a reasonable statement. Yes,
or technocratic coup.
Yes,
but that seems fitting, I think, to the situation.
Yes. Well, look. Let's stick with Tony Blair a little bit and see if we can understand why he's still around, because many people ask this question, why is this man not in prison? Why is he not being sorted out by The Hague and so on? But this article recently published by Defend WikiLeaks perhaps gives us a clue. What has WikiLeaks revealed about the Blair and Brown governments? Well, let's just pick a couple of items out of this. First of all, undermining the Iraq inquiry. The Brown government undermined the Chilcot inquiry it launched in 2009 into the Iraq war by immediately making promises to the US just as the inquiry was beginning in 2009. Ministry of Defense Director for Security Policy John Day promised a senior US official that the government had put measures in place to protect your interests during the inquiry. So the WikiLeaks seemed to be demonstrating that the inquiry was fixed. But more importantly, perhaps, rigging the International Criminal Court. Another WikiLeaks file shows how the US and Britain rigged the International Criminal Court to stop it being able to hold Blair and Bush accountable for the crime of aggression over Iraq. So I absolutely recommend this article. Go and have a read at it and see how this was achieved. And the final point here is the fact that the UK and the US work together to prevent reform of the financial system, and the fact that in 2009, Douglas Alexander, Secretary of State for International Development, and John Sawyers, then UK Permanent Representative to the UN, who later that year became the chief of MI6, held a meeting with the US Ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, and they're saying that a US cable, I guess, available through WikiLeaks, says that Alexander and Sawyers began the meeting by noting their concern that Cuba, Iran, Venezuela, and other radical G77 countries would use the upcoming June UN conference on the world financial and economic crisis and its impact on development to push for an outcome document that would, for the first time, give the UN General Assembly a role in negotiating on revamping the Bretton Woods financials. Now, this is slightly different to what I've just mentioned previously, but I included this because mainly because Venezuela and Iran are included in that particular section, and it does seem interesting that these are both targets of current U.S. policy.
And by the way, Susan Rice is Chatham House. Some people aren't aware of that. So she does have that affiliation to the British deep state.
Right. Okay. Right, now let's move quickly on. I just want to briefly mention and remind everybody that tomorrow Lynn Thayer's extradition hearing is taking place in the Royal Courts of Justice in the Strand in London. That's from 10 a.m. tomorrow. If anybody can get along to support Lynn Thayer, that would be really great. If you don't remember or if you don't know who Lynn Thayer is, watch Friday's UK column news. This is the business partner of David Noakes, and they were, of course, producing or making GCMAF available to people suffering from illnesses, including cancer. And, of course, David Noakes currently in prison for having been found guilty of distributing a medication without a license. And this extradition hearing is because Lynn Thayer is, or at least the French government, is attempting to bring similar charges against her and bring her to France to face trial. And of course, the problem with this is that the French, there is no such thing as bail in France. You go to prison while the investigation and trial process takes place. So this is a really unpleasant situation for undeserved completely. She faced no charges in the UK because the UK government, the UK authorities did not feel that she deserved to face any charges here. And so this just seems like, I don't really know how to describe what this is. Pretty.
It's similar to double jeopardy, really. So.
So, mm-hmm. Extradition hearing tomorrow. Get along to support her if you possibly can. Okay, now, OPCW weapons report, Patrick. Over the weekend, Peter Hitchens published a report on this.
Yes, he did, and this is quite significant, actually. So what happened here? Well, we spoke about this in last week's show. We did a nice segment on this report, did a review, and flagged up some of the anomalies in this report, this long, much-anticipated report. This is based on the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma, Syria. Last April, this was the attack that triggered a tripartite airstrike between the U.S., the U.K., and France against the Syrian Arab Republic, based on, at the time, what was claimed to be evidence of sarin and chlorine WMDs attacking, Assad attacking his own people, essentially. So we reviewed this. There's a video of this up on 21st Century Wire right now, which is basically cut from last week's UK Column News program. I do encourage people to go look at that and share it. It's up on YouTube as well. But Peter Hitchens, this is significant. Why? This is one of the first mainstream media persons of note to break rank and actually talk about this report, Mike, because we have not seen anything in terms of coverage from this. So Peter Hitchens, Mail on Sunday columnist, also a noted British historian. A lot of people don't realize he has published a number of excellent books, and he is very well known in terms of his veracity of research and a great all-around writer over the years. Now, he put together, Mike, a very detailed critique of this report, and I do encourage people to go to Peter Hitchens' blog here on the Mail on Sunday, and it's, the title of this article is Some Thoughts on the Latest OPCW Report on Alleged Use of Poison Gas at Douma, Syria in 2018. And so he's putting together, it's what's good about this, especially because Peter Hitchens understands the media and he works in the mainstream media, so he absolutely understands the political implications of everything that goes to print. And so this is not only a critique of the report, but it's also putting it in context of the media coverage of the report and how this these events are interpreted by the mainstream media, by the establishment. So, and we'll look at a few of the things that he said here. Now, he said it would be perfectly possible for a media organization already wedded to the idea, this is important, that Syria used gas on this occasion, to read this report, the OC, and say to themselves, the OPCW confirms a chlorine attack at Douma. Now, this is what would be called confirmation bias, Mike. And so this is a really important concept. And I think this says a lot about Peter Hitchens as a journalist to come out front and center with this point at the beginning of his critique of this report. So, and he goes on and he says, personally, I think the OPCW's inclusion in its report of so-called open source materials, he's referring a lot to Bellingcat here. This is the open source investigation organization, allegedly independent, based in The Hague in the Netherlands. And he said, such as films purporting to show events in Douma is an absurdity. They rightly say that they don't attach great weight to them, but they would be better to leave them in the annexes. So he's really saying this over-reliance on what they call open source material, which is stuff floating out in the internet, YouTube videos and things like this. So, and we've flagged this up and we've made this critique many times on this report, but on over the years as well, is this obsession by Western governments or this leaning on what they call open source materials. They've done this on almost every occasion with all of these so-called WMD attacks. And here we have Peter Hitchens questioning this, which was more or less taken to be sacred by today's political class. And he goes on, says, I really don't see how much films can be forensically assessed in the way that the chemical content of a soil or other samples can be assessed. This is a good point. The whole point of the OPCW is to be forensic and diligent about hard, clear things such as custody chains, so as to be based only on hard, clean, researched material, free from any possibility of tampering. So he's really, what he's talking about is that why don't international investigations into WMD attacks, the sort of things that trigger wars, why don't they raise to the same level of criminal justice standards as normal investigations into even misdemeanors or felonies here in the domestic setting? So fair question, and again, a question that we've raised many times, so it's good to see Peter Hitchens also raising this same question. And he says, first, I'll just bung in here a quote from an anonymous engineer whose opinions on the report's astonishing claims for the behavior of the alleged gas cylinders seems interesting, says Hitchens. And he says, as the OPCW does not name its expert, I won't name mine. Fair enough, we say to Peter Hitchens, though he's a highly experienced person. This is what he said. This is the words of the engineer that Peter Hitchens has consulted. I have looked at the pictures of the cylinder and the hole in the concrete roof, and I can say with a high degree of confidence that the cylinder lying on the bed did not cause the hole, regardless of the speed at which the assumed contact occurred. This is very important. What is he referring to? He's referring to magic cylinder number one at the location number four. This is straight from the OPCW report. You can see the selfie here of the moderate rebel in Douma posing with the newly arrived chlorine bomb, which has landed in roughly mint condition nicely on the bed. It's a beautiful bed. It's a lovely bedroom, in fact. And there's the hole. So that hole, according to this engineer, consulted by Peter Hitchens, did not come via that canister. So this is just one of many things, Mike, in this report that actually don't add up at all.
Well, as you would imagine, Peter Hitchens got quite a backlash from this. So one question that was asked, though, that I thought was quite amusing was Alistair Bunkle here on Twitter saying, has Peter Hitchens been to Syria? And of course, the implication is, what the hell does he know? He's never even been there, sort of thing. And Hitchens' response No, I've never been to Syria. With my long history of severe public criticism of the Assad state, I thought it was unwise to go there. So that pretty much silences every critic, because he has been absolutely a critic of Syria. He's of the Syrian government. He is no friend, or has been no friend, to Bashar al-Assad. So for him to take this position, in spite of that position on the Syrian government, takes the rug out from under the critics.
Really. See those tweets again really quick. I just want to point out, Mike, that's Alistair Buncall. He's a national security or defense correspondent.
Yes.
For guess who? It says Sky News. Okay.
Yes.
So you have a Sky News person there, a defense person, lecturing Peter Hitchens, who arguably is much more qualified, probably twice his age to boot. So isn't it incredible, the things that you see on Twitter? It's amazing.
Absolutely. Okay, now just quickly, speaking of Syria, we've got things ramping up a little bit at the moment. AMN here reporting the Syrian army unleashing large-scale attacks on jihadist stronghold. This is a result of attacks from the jihadis on the Syrian government forces. So, well, that's going on. In the meantime, U.S. coalition strike on Baghouz kills at least 50 civilians. This is according to Sputnik. So this is all ramping up a little bit. There's, you know, pockets of so-called moderate rebels, and by that we mean terrorists, to get rid of. But, you know, we note that despite the criticism that the Syrian government and their Russian allies were killing civilians as a result of their attacks on some of the rebel strongholds. The U.S. don't seem to be concerned too much about the number of civilians get killed, but that's neither here nor there. In the meantime, the U.K., well, here's Alistair Burt, because he's very excited that the U.K. is pledging another £400 million of life-saving aid to the 2019 Syria crisis response to help those who need it most. And he said the humanitarian situation is still critical, with millions of people displaced across the region since the conflict began. Our pledge is a clear commitment that UK support to the Syrian people is steadfast. Really, Mr. Burt, who exactly is this support going to? Because it's not going to anybody that's in Syria as a nation under the Syrian government, is it? Because I believe we've still got sanctions on the Syrian government at the moment. So this humanitarian aid, in inverted commas, is going to be going to the rebel-held, terrorist-held areas. Patrick, I wonder what will be in this aid. Will it be medical supplies? Will it be weapons? What will it be?
Will it be satellite phones? Will it be all of the things that have been funneled to Idlib over the years and to East Aleppo? Yeah, so it doesn't look too promising.
Well, the point is that the modus operandi of the Foreign Office continues. They continue to double down in the last-ditch effort to support their tame terrorists.
In increasingly smaller areas.
Absolutely,
as well.
The
terrorist rebels are being squeezed into ever more smaller pockets. In fact, there's only one area the White Helmets are able to operate in now, because the White Helmets have been rejected by the entire country of Syria. They don't want to see them, so they can only work in terrorist-held, al-Qaeda-held Idlib. This is where the White Helmets, which are supported by the U.S. government and by British government, who work alongside terrorist groups, this is the last place that they're allowed. The Kurds don't even want them. Mm. They can't even set up shop north of the Euphrates. They're that unpopular, actually. So it's funny to see everybody in government still taking selfies with them.
Okay, let's talk about Venezuela.
This is an extraordinary story. So we're going to put up the big breaking news, Chiron. Breaking news. What is so exciting? Well, the mainstream media admits to fake news. Well, sort of. This story popped up in the New York Times just over the weekend. Footage contradicts U.S. claim that Maduro burned aid convoys. Of course, this is no surprise to us, because we did report 2 weeks ago on this exact thing, and we said how the media and the U.S. politicians have got it wrong. the U.S. State Department's got it wrong, and they're parroting fake news. Well, here's the New York Times. The New York Times has done a video analysis. It took them 2 weeks to catch up to us, so it's good that they did that. But the analysis itself is very good. It's very telling, although it is packaged into a little anti-Maduro propaganda film made by the New York Times. I do encourage people to go watch this film. It's very interesting. You'll also see the propaganda elements inserted by the New York Times. So while it calls out the Trump administration and Republicans very well, in fact, and shows the fakery, it also demonizes the Maduro government, mm-hmm. So with all the same talking points. So some progress by the New York Times, but let's look at how this came about. This came about as a result of Colombian government fakery. So the videos were released and of the aid convoys burning. This is on Santander Bridge, the border of Venezuela and Colombia. And the Colombian government released some video. And it's very interesting. They released video, but they took out what looks like 13 minutes were deleted. The part they took out was, in fact, confirming what we reported here on the UK column a few weeks ago, which was that the Maduro government or police did not set the aid convoys on fire. They were actually set on fire by Guaido mobs, mm-hmm. the mobs supporting the U.S.-backed puppet Juan Guaido. And this is now proven. And here's a picture of what was cut out. That's the exact moment where one of the Guaido mob vigilantes threw a Molotov cocktail, which landed onto the aid convoy, which set fire to the aid convoy. That's what really happened. But at the time, we're going to say it's important to point out what the government and the media were saying. Minutes after this came out, you have Marco Rubio basically saying that the Maduro police set fire to the aid convoy. So that's the senator from Florida, John Bolton, masked thugs, civilians, killed by live rounds in burning trucks, carrying badly needed food and aid. I mean, there's three or four lies in this tweet by John Bolton. And then, of course, you have Mark Green from USAID parroting the same talking points, saying, Maduro ordered the firing and burning of trucks with humanitarian aid. Let's not forget who USAID is, that they are a front for the Central Intelligence Agency. And this is a proven fact. They've been deployed in this fashion in many different places around the world. This is not debatable. So whether all USAID programs are CIA fronts, probably not, but the CIA have used USAID to great effect, especially for regime change operations and for basically weakening states and causing trouble and disruptions throughout history. That's a fact. So Mike Pompeo, this is what he said as a result of this fake news at the time. The sick tyrant Maduro, who's denying food and to sick Venezuelans and medicine to sick Venezuelans, burning trucks. Well, that's not what happened, Mike.
No.
What is that?
That's fake news.
That's fake news. And the same Elliot Abrams, the same talking point, made it to the UN. Here he is. This is the U.S. Special Representative for Venezuela. And armed gangs, thugs, criminals released from prisons, that's a lie, were mobilized to control the border. That didn't happen. Well, if it did, it was from the Colombian side. Those were the Guaido mobs. But he's making it sound like the Maduro government released prisoners to wreak havoc at the border. He said their actions led to the burning of humanitarian assistance. Well, he's half right there. But at the end of the day, what is this? Well, it's more fake news. So you can see how this system works. This is very interesting. So this is this is a picture of a real Venezuelan police officer, okay? And what's he saying? Stop, let's cease the aggression. He's talking to the Guaido mobs with the Molotov cocktails as they're throwing them on and burning the aid, okay? So these aren't thugs released from prison. These are Venezuelan police officers here and showing great restraint. That's what really happened. So Mike Pompeo, the U.S. Secretary of State, is lying. John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, is lying. Senator Marco Rubio is lying. The entire mainstream press lied as a result of this and mischaracterized this. And what it did, here's the original, actually. This is from a so-called opposition media outlet. This is the tweet that sort of got the ball rolling here. Urgent, PMB burns three humanitarian aid trucks. And, of course, Rubio and the others riffed off this immediately. And of course, they continue here to say, citizens' attempt to save some of the humanitarian aid that was burned by the Maduro government on Santander Bridge. So that's how the fake news rolled out initially on Twitter. That's NTN24, opposition-leaning media outlet there. And so we did cover this in great detail a few weeks ago when we talked about the Venezuelan crisis and the Great Imperialist Roadshow. And we showed you this exactly what went down and who was responsible. We explained how this happened. And we even showed you, well, this is Venezuela's Telesur media also denouncing this as a false flag operation. They're correct. This was a false flag. Mm. But if you said false flag at the time, you were called a conspiracy theorist. So it's confirmed. It was a false flag. And we even showed you the video. We'll show it to you again. These are the Guaido mobs making Molotov cocktails. We showed this to you a few weeks ago. Maybe this is what triggered this video online, triggered the New York Times to look a little closer. But my question, Mike, is if we saw this and we drew these conclusions, which are obvious, why did the mainstream media, why is it taking them 2 or 3 weeks to finally draw these same conclusions that we drew? But the damage is already done.
Well, I suspect that the main reason is because they've been embarrassed into publishing this, perhaps because there's been enough coverage in alternative media, on social media, to force them to take a look at it. Because
I think you're right.
Yeah,
I think that's what was it. But here's the important part. This is what it resulted in because of this fake news, because of the propaganda, the misinformation pumped out by all the mainstream media outlets and then parroted by politicians in the United States and beyond. Mike Pence announces new sanctions against Maduro regime officials in Venezuela. This is CBS was running point on this whole propaganda campaign, by the way. So there's Mike Pence there with the U.S.'s pick for president there, Juan Guaido, and another Venezuelan opposition person there. So that's the result, policy. So fake news becomes policy. Fake news becomes, in some cases, even war, as we've learned from the supposed chemical weapons attack in Douma. That fake news, we showed this last week, mm-hmm. led to war. So let's look at this cycle. This is how it's done. The government media fake news cycle, okay? There's various variations of this, but I'll just run you through the scenario which we've just illustrated. And please, we encourage you to show this to some of your friends. First, how does this cycle start? Opposition media outlet reports story. In this case, it was NTN24 from Venezuela. That's the first stage in this cycle. The next stage is the newswire agencies pick this story up. It could be Reuters, it could be AP, could be a number of other news agencies, mainline news agencies. That launders the story, gives it legitimacy. And then that becomes safe at that point for politicians to pick it up. Although in this case, you could say that it even bypassed that stage in the cycle, and Marco Rubio and others picked it up directly from the original fake news, which was put out by the opposition media outlets. The same exact thing happened in Syria time and time again with the so-called opposition media outlets, some of which are funded actually by the U.S. government or the French government and the EU. So the next stage, the MSN outlets then pick up the story. This could be CNN, the BBC, or others. And then after that, government officials start tweeting the outrage and so forth. The public reaction is then expected. There's fear. There's outrage. Something must be done. What are you going to do about it? And of course, then there's Mike Pence. In this case, the last stage, policy change, sanctions, or it could be war in the case of Douma. So, Mike, that is it. That's the government media complex. That's the fake news cycle.
Sanctions or it could be war, of course, starting on Thursday, Venezuela experiencing blanket blackouts. The Venezuelan government, the Maduro government, saying that this is a result of some kind of attack on the national grid of Venezuela. So sanctions or war, is that what we're looking at? We're actually looking at some kind of hybrid warfare going on at the moment?
That's an act of war.
Right.
If you're sabotaging a national power grid to cut power, that's an act of war. And that's normally what happens, Mike, before you do actually go in for a military bombing or intervention. So in the case of Venezuela, is this a prelude to U.S. military intervention? In this case, I don't think so. But we have seen things like this done in Iraq or in Syria or in Lebanon. In the case of Israel, attacking will normally take out power plants. We did this in Iraq, our militaries as well. So this is standard practice. But in the case of Venezuela, it should be construed as an act of war. There's hospitals, there's people who depend on power and electricity. People may have died or could die as a result of mass power cuts.
So obviously the intention here is to create an opposition within Venezuela against the Maduro government. And so it's increasingly less likely that there's going to be an actual intervention from the United States side or from the countries around about. But what are the chances, do you think, that what they're doing with the power system and the other interventions, hybrid warfare interventions, could result in a move of public opinion towards the so-called opposition?
This is what the U.S. are hoping. And if you listen to the comments by John Bolton, and we didn't cover this in detail on this program, but we could do in the future on another program, Mike. But John Bolton specifically said to the media, he said that I'm on Twitter to talk directly to the Venezuelan people. I am tweeting in Spanish and in English. Okay, so immediately after the power cut, John Bolton tweeted, this is years of corruption by the Maduro regime. This is why there's a power cut. They're stealing all the money from the Venezuelan people and not upgrading the power grid, and this is why there is a blackout. But, of course, the explanation that looks to be more likely is something completely different. There was sabotage there, and the U.S. officials tweeted within minutes of this happening, even before it was really reported in detail on the media as to what happened and why. So they seem to have advanced knowledge. I'm talking about Marco Rubio specifically. But that seems to be the case, Mike, that they're using social media in the U.S. Officials believe that they can communicate the weakness of the Maduro regime, as they call it, to the opposition in Venezuela. So they're hoping to leverage social media in this way. I think they might be overestimating their credibility in this case, but nonetheless, this is exactly what we're seeing.
Okay. Thank you very much, Patrick. We will leave it there for today. Thank you very much for joining us today. We'll be back at the same time, 1 p.m. on Wednesday. Now, if you like what we're doing and you'd like to support us, then please do so. You can do that by looking at the UK Column Community website, and we have various options for you there. Please do get involved if you would like to. Thank you very much for joining us. As I say, we'll be back on Wednesday. We will see you then. Bye-bye.